I think it's been a long time since we did a piece by Rabbi Riskin, so I guess we'll go there tonight. So, Parashas Balosra, I feel like we've been there so many times over the years of like, ugh, like how does it happen that the Jewish people fail so miserably? And every year I'm in the same point, but we get to Balosra and we're like, what happened? Where did they go wrong? So I guess that's what we're going to try to do tonight. We're going to try to understand a little bit one of the critical stories in Parshas Balosra of where the Jewish people really mess up and maybe offer a different possible explanation of exactly what point drove them over to the deep end. So with that, here we go. Vahiyam kimit onanim rabbi aznei Hashem. So the people were mit'onanim, which I think somewhere, maybe it's Rabbi Sachs, translates it as murmurers, right? They're not like full-out complainers, but there's a lot of like, right? So they're ra, it's bad, be'aznei Hashem, in the ears of God, v'yishma Hashem v'yicharapo. And God hears it, and he gets angry, v'tivarvam eish Hashem v'tochal b'kzeh ha'machaneh. And God consumes them with fire, and it eats the edge of the camp. So God strikes out at some of the Jews because of this murmuring. All right. So a couple of questions. First off, mitonanim is like a little bit of a newish kind of word. We're used to more like mitlonanim, which is like complainers, right? And we know that there's no shortage of complaints that the Jewish people have. Also, what's interesting is that it seems as though God is much angrier here than he is in Sefer Shmos, meaning there's plenty of times that the Jews complain in Sefer Shmos, right? Right when Moshe shows up, they complain right away, like, what did you do? Like, you made it worse for us. And then they're like at Yitzias Mitzrayim is just about done, and they're at like Kriyas Yamsuf, and they complain again. And they're right after Kriyas Yamsuf. There's no water, and there's no food, and there's no this, and there's no that. There's constant complaining. And yet God seems to have a much more merciful approach in Sefer Shmos as opposed to Bamidbar.
It's like the murmuring part of it. It's like much more passive-aggressive. It's like, okay, they got to complain, say it. If this murmuring is much as...
Okay, good. That's a possibility, right? Like, just be honest. Like, if you have a problem with me, tell me. Like, don't, like, yeah.
This is also, they've been with him for a while.
Right, so I think that that's like, see, the problem is they really haven't been that long of a while. It's like a little bit over a year.
There's a large difference, I think, between just leaving and him really taking care of them significantly while they've been in the Midbar, time and time again. And
right now they shouldn't know enough.
Right, so I kind of feel like, yesterday Yael and I were walking and we were talking about like a bat mitzvah speech topic potentially, Parshas Chukas, which again is not nowhere near her bat mitzvah, but like since her bat mitzvah is in September, whatever. Anyhow, so we're having this whole conversation and like we're talking about like when Miriam dies and the Jewish people complain that there's no water, right? She's like, I like that story. I mean, not in a good way, but it's a beautiful, there's a lot there. Right? But like there, I get, you see, Steve, that's where it's like 40 years. So you're like, after 40 years, like God has done so much. It's like 1 year. Like they were slaves for a really long time. Like they're 1 year past that. Again, you're right that God should give them more of a path. Like in a certain sense, Rabbi Liebtag describes it like as the development of the people from like baby to child to grown up. So, okay, so they're not a newborn anymore. They're an infant. But, like, you still have, like, rachmanis on an infant. If your 14-year-old were to, like, start, like, throwing a temper tantrum, you'd go, like, you'd lose it. If it's your 1-year-old, like, it's sort of par for the course.
But the one, like, I guess the point, I mean, between year 1 and year 40, it's not really that much difference in terms of what's been going on. This past year has been, all the big stuff, so to speak, has happened over that past year where they should... No, but they're not an infant. At least
between. I think it has to do with whether it's a legitimate complaint or not. So when they're at the Yam Suf, they don't know what to do because there's a sea and there's the Egyptians
they complain, and God says, okay, they're right to complain.
Okay.
And they say, we don't have water. He's like, they're right, they don't have water. It's okay to complain. They don't have food. But now they had water. They had food. God's taken care of them for a year, and look at what they're complaining about. They're complaining about how good it was for them in Egypt. Meanwhile, they were tortured and enslaved. Who knows what they actually ate? I don't think it was all the fish and the water.
Right. I guess the truth is, like, we're at the point where we don't even have, we're not even up to that, right? Like, you're jumping the gun and going to Pasuk Dalid. Right, but here they're just like, we don't even know what they're complaining about. Like, they're not even complaining about the provisions yet. They're just complaining, maybe for the sake of complaining.
It's like social media.
If it's
when it's a direct approach, you hear it and it's fine. When there's rumors going on, if the rumor must be true.
I hear.
This is actually much more dangerous the way social media is. I read it's online. It must be true.
So, I hear. I read an amazing quote. I read through the entire Hank Sixth Grade Yearbook yesterday. Makes for really good reading. Before you know it, you'll get to read it, right? It's my job to edit it. So this kid had the best quote. It was, just because you can speak doesn't mean you're intelligent. And that's, I think, to your point, like, you know, like, we, just because it's out on the internet, like, doesn't mean it's true and doesn't mean that there's any validity to it. But we talk a lot. And that kind of gets us into a lot of trouble. So, yeah.
Is there something to the, just the two words of Yishma Hashem, right after it says, Hashem? Like, what's the difference?
So, I mean, it is interesting because normally it's not Be'aznei Hashem.
Right.
It's Be'enei Hashem, right? And then it would be Vayar Hashem.
So
right, why is this... Why is it the ears of God, and why does God listen? I don't know.
Well, how else? Obviously, if it's the ears. I'd say it's redundant as opposed to.
Right, but we do see that in Tanakh where it'll be like be'enei, right? Vayar be'enei, whatever. Like, obviously, it was be'enei. But I think the key word here is ra, right? Like, the narration is telling us that God is not happy. Like, this is, right. But I guess the question is, why? Why is Hashem's reaction much harsher, and why does God get so angry here? But then, Pasuk Bet, Vayitzaka Amel Moshe, Vayitpalel Moshe Hashem, Vayitishka Eish. God, right, the people cry out to God, to Moshe, Moshe davens to God, and the fire subsides. Vayikrashem HaMakom Ahu Taveira, Ki Varavam Eish Hashem. So they call this place Taveira, because they were consumed by the fire of God.
Part in the sequence where the people, instead of complaining to Moshe, should just daven, instead of complaining to Moshe, and Moshe davening, and just daven.
Oh, you're saying, why, right, why don't they daven to God directly?
Have they done that yet?
I don't know if they've done that yet. Let's see. What do we see by Kriyas Yamsuf? Do they watch out? Do they cry out to... I don't think they cry out to Hashem.
Doesn't Moshe rebuke
and
say, why are you complaining to me?
Well, he says that, right? He says, like, Mati Tzaki Lai, like, why, right? Or God, actually, God says that to Moshe, right? Why are you wasting your time? Don't talk to me. Like, speak to the Jews and travel. Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's like a long time ago. It's the first Chabura, I think, on Parshas Beshalach, maybe, or Chukas, one of them. Probably Beshalach, because Chukas was summertime. But it's the idea that why does Moshe hit the rock? So Rav Saratskin suggests that actually Moshe was supposed to inspire the people. And if he had inspired the people would jump along, they'd all pray together, and everything would be wonderful, and then God would redeem them and give them water. But Moshe starts and tries to, like, get the people, like, worked up into, like, a prayer frenzy, and nothing happens because they're so dependent upon Moshe. So I think it's possible that that's the reason why they're like,
so
Moshe...
Learned behavior.
Yeah. But again, like, you know, if you think about it, when your leader is like Moshe, then you don't feel that you need to do anything.
Yeah. I mean, they only had one leader. They're not comparing them to anybody. Okay.
Right.
But it's going to work.
I disagree with that general statement. I think often, and you see this a lot of time in offices, when you have one strong person, they often take on a lot of responsibility, or the boss is doing it, so therefore the underling doesn't like volunteer.
Right.
So they had a strong leader, and there was no so it could be, it's not just because Moshe was such a huge leader; it was just a.
Right. I'm not criticizing Moshe. I think that I think we're saying the same thing. When you have someone of that magnitude, you don't feel like you have to do it because he'll take care of it.
I don't think it's that magnitude. I just think when you have someone that they're comfortable with their leadership in general, there's the same result. It's just, I don't think the magnitude is the issue. That's all.
Okay. Fair. I think either way, the people don't feel that they need to really do much because they're like, we've got Moshe, and Moshe will take care of it. You know, I guess it's like the Hasidic Rebbe. You know, like he can do it. So like, I'm not necessary in the process. Whereas like, I don't know, you go to Rav Schachter and he's like, well, what are you coming to me? I don't know, like go grab a Tehillim and like start davening. But I think that's possible. That's part of the reason why they don't do anything. And then Pasuk Dalet. Vasavsufa shevakir bo hitavu tava vayashuvu vayivku gam bnei Yisrael vayimru miachilin basar. So this is where like you sit there and you're like, really? Like, so there's this asavsuf, which like, for lack of a better word, they're like riffraff, right? The riffraff amongst them. Now, it's possible that these are people that Moshe Rabbeinu felt we should bring out, right? They've got like redeeming qualities to them. It's going to be okay. And God was like, all right, like, you can take them, but, like, they're on your, like, cheshbon. I don't think that they're worth coming. They're not Jewish. Don't bring them. And Moshe says, that's going to be fine. So they wanted stuff. And then they sat and they cried, all of Bnei Yisrael, and they said, who's going to give us meat? It's like, oh, like, what does that mean? Right, all of a sudden, they're like, where are we going to get meat from? We remember the fish that we ate for free in Egypt, and the gourds, the watermelon, the leek, the onions, and the garlic.
But not the meat.
Not right. Well, the meat, that I guess they wanted meat, but these are the things we remember. And all we have is man. No, I don't know. Man, midrashically, is anything you want it to be. So, like, that's a pretty good job. Like, if you could have whatever you want, amazing. Of course, I believe the Medrash says that there were five things it couldn't be. Gourds, watermelon, leek, onion, and garlic. Right? So what they're saying is, we could have everything in the whole wide world, but we don't want any of that. We just want these five things, right? Because we can't have them.
Then why would they be crying out for meat?
Yeah, fair point. So the other alternative is that they were just upset because the man was the same thing, meaning whatever it was. Now, I don't know, like from its description in Beshalach, it really sounds like it's like a donut, like fried dough. I think I could handle that.
Forever?
Well, I mean, could you eat anything forever? Oh. Right, but there's a lot, meaning like...
You had to pick one.
No, right, like, so, like, here's the thing. If, like, you had to pick one cereal for breakfast for the rest of your life, like, I think that'd be rough. Like, because I do like every once in a while having, like, to change it up. But it'd be different that if you told me, like, I have to have cornflakes for the rest of my life. I mean, like, if you told me Golden Grahams for the rest of my life, I think I'd sign up for it. I mean, I would love to, like, change it up every once in a while. You should see how quickly Golden Grahams goes in my house. We buy the Walmart bag. It's like bigger than some of my children. It only lasts a week.
The mon was not just... They could bake it, they could cook it. You could do other things with mon. Right? Because Moshe says...
Yeah, but I don't know...
Bake. Whatever you want to cook, cook. Because Shabbos is coming.
Yeah, but I mean, I don't know how much there really was that you could do with it.
You could probably do more with it than it just... It wasn't something you just picked up and ate off the ground. I think it was like a basic ingredient. And then, I don't know why we always think that they had nothing...
Were they going to get anything else?
Well, what else did they have?
Well,
they weren't trading with anybody?
Well, who were they?
Actually, no.
There were no trades people coming down.
I don't think anyone meant just wanted to have anything to do with them.
you know, in
I mean, I guess anything is possible.
Yeah, in Devorim, though, it's like when Moshe tries to make some sort of treaty with today.
Right, Edom and right, Edom.
And he said, "Well, you know, we'll pay for whatever we eat." You know.
Yeah, but that's in like year 40.
But my point though is that, well, if they had the mud, they didn't need to eat anything. They needed to pay for anything because they weren't going to eat anything.
Right. So Rashi does address that. Rashi says that it's like common courtesy. Right, like if I'm gonna go through your like whatever, even though I might have plenty of my own provisions, I should go to your local makolet. I should go, you know, whatever. I should shop local, even though I don't need it. I have everything, but still, we just feel that that's the right and appropriate thing to do.
So, if you believe that they came out of Egypt carrying all the timber and all the leathers that they were going to need for the Mishkan, because they somehow knew we're going to have to build a Mishkan when we get to this desert, which was never part of the original plan anyway.
Right.
It makes no sense. Clearly, they were getting these things from somewhere. There's no timber in the desert. They were tradespeople coming down the route, and they were trading with them.
I mean, right. Yeah.
The temple was nowhere near the Sinai Desert.
So where is it? I suppose it's somewhere the Pamphlets said that they would pick up on the way out.
Right. It could be a dip. Right. I don't know.
I don't know why we have to look for the weird story and not think that maybe the caravans that were always traveling would somehow pass by and trade with them.
Right. So I mean, first, well, actually, the truth.
2 million people.
It's a captive market. Where are they going?
Saying how many?
Right.
Henry,
you're also assuming that there, I mean, like, I know that there was a trade route, right? Like, it was the one that went down all the way into Egypt. You're assuming that anybody wanted to, like, trade with Egypt. Like, Egypt's economy, right? Because we're going to accept that, like, the story that of Yetzias Mitzrayim is how we view it, right? Like, Egypt was devastated. How much, like, was there much of an economy? Like, did the trade route dry up a little bit?
You have to look at history also. This Egypt was still a power for a pretty long time, up until Rome. Egypt was still, Rome didn't just steamroll over Egypt.
So I'm not going to pretend that I have, like, a good, like, historical perspective on that. But, like, at least from a biblical perspective, I think I have, like, Egypt is, like, silent for a while. So, okay, it happens to, let's assume that Egypt began its, like, rise back to prominence well before it, you know, comes back in the times of Shlomo HaMelech. Because I think that's the first time we really hear of Egypt. And that's a good 400 years after Yetzias Mitzrayim. Nonetheless, like, if you believe that, like, the Makos happened and you believe that Egypt was devastated, it is possible that the 40 years of the Jews were in the desert, that it did not have the same economy. I mean, again, you'd have to look at history and see, like, I'm sure Egypt had its ups and downs along the way. Like, it might have been, like, you know, overall, like, somewhat of a powerful nation, but, like, was it always like that for the entire, like, trajectory? I don't know. But anyway, yeah, I mean, listen, Henry, I'm not saying you're wrong that there weren't tradesmen. It's possible. But it's also possible that they had water and that they had the dough and they dealt with it and whatever. I am comfortable with the Medrash that the man tasted like whatever you wanted. And I'm also comfortable, despite that, with the people complaining. So I guess their concern was that there was a finite number of animals and they didn't want to necessarily give them up. Also, were the animals being used, you know, as means of transportation?
Goats and sheep.
Oh, I hear the little ones, right?
I mean, a flock of sheep, if you leave them alone... I don't know how long it takes for them to double.
And some
they don't create. It's not like you left Egypt with 50 sheep, and 40 years later, you have 50 sheep.
Right. I hear.
Flocks grow, and they're meant to be eaten. They used the wool, right, because the wool was used to weaken. So that means they killed some sheep.
Right.
They were bringing carbonos, so they had animals.
Right. Yeah, so maybe they just didn't want to, like...
You do know you don't have to kill the sheep to take the wool. The sheepskin coat, you definitely have to kill them. I'm just saying.
That's a valid point.
Yeah, in the desert. Definitely did not need that in the desert. Okay, yeah. All fair points. Okay, so the Torah now tells us that man kizra gadhu ve'enokein avadolach shatu am v'laktu v'rtachnu v'reichayim odachu v'mdocha u'vishu v'parur v'asu togot v'yat tamo ketam l'shat ha'shamen. Okay, so Henry does point out he was a step or two ahead of us. That this is what it describes it as. It had like, it was like coriander seed, and the people collected it, and they put it through the mill, and they cooked it, they turned it into cakes, and its taste was like oily. So, I don't know, I mean like... Yeah, but okay, so it had like
a sweet doughy taste.
So I don't know. I mean, you could think like malawa, you could think challah, pita, like any of those things. So at night, when the dew came down on the land, the man came on top of it. And that's the story. But then we're told, "Vayishma Moshe adam bochel mishpichotav yishlo petach alo veicharaf Hashem od veinei Moshe ra." So what happens? Moshe hears the people crying by their crying by their families, each one by their door, their tent. God gets angry, and it's bad in the eyes of Moshe. What are they crying about here?
I don't know, but they're not crying inside their tents.
So bochet lit mishpechotav. What does that mean? So now, if it means they are crying with their families, what should it be? Bochet im mishpechotav, or bochet maybe b'mishpechotav. But what's lit mishpechotav? So Rashi says that this is what they were crying about. They were crying about the fact that God would not let them have free reign with their family. Meaning they're rallying against God's decree that incest is bad. And a lot of the arayos were what they were complaining about. So, bochel mishpechotav by petach ha'alo. Their concern is the things that happen within the tent. That is what they are complaining about.
How did we get to that?
How did we?
Why does it always go to that lowest common denominator? Why does it have to get to that point? They're thinking about incest. Why would you think that?
Did they do that in Egypt?
I don't know. So I guess probably, it could be that some people did that there. I would not be, I mean, based upon the Torah's, like what they talk about in terms of Egypt, I think that the Torah's perspective would be that you probably found that kind of stuff in Egypt. And certainly like illicit relations were rampant in Egypt,
among the Egyptians.
So did that like trickle down to the Jews? Probably not the Jews that left Egypt, maybe the ones that didn't make it. So it could be the Asaf Suf. Or it could also be that what it's saying is that what the people were saying is they were frustrated with the restrictive nature of what the Torah told us.
I don't have any problem with that because there are a tremendous number of restrictions.
Right, so like...
Those have to take it to the... They wanted to do, like, the weird stuff.
Right, so what if you want to go on that route? So you could say, like, what were their complaints? Like, things like...
Want, like a cheeseburger or something like that.
Right, but no, but if you want to talk about in the realm of relationships, so you might say, like, the Hilchos Nida and that kind of stuff would be stuff that's like... You know, was frustrating to them. Maybe the fact that I don't know how they did. That's a really good question.
The Arab area like broke up into little local street vendors, and
maybe that's why there's some mikvos that are named Be'er Miriam to this very day.
Don't we say that they didn't have the regular physical, like they didn't have to, there was no waste from the Mon. So you could also, if you're already saying that, you could also.
And no, right, nobody got you. Nobody, right, there was no menstruation for 40
years. 40 years, everything was on hold. Men didn't have a bris mila.
Right. They did have kids. That we know. People gave birth. I don't know. It's a good question. But again, I think that could be the answer, is that it's more, the complaint is more about the restrictive nature of the Torah, as opposed to like going to the like most base common denominator. Okay.
It says they were crying for their families. Maybe they were scared because they're still recovering from the loss of the fire that consumed them. Maybe they're scared for their families. Like,
okay.
What's Hashem going to get mad at us for next? What's Hashem going to do next?
That's an excellent way of looking at it, and could definitely be a fair read. So what happens? Vayomer Moshe Hashem, lama hariot al avdecha v'lama tzadicha v'necha l'asu ma'asak ol mezeh lai. So Moshe loses it. Moshe turns to God and says, why did you do this to me? Right? Why did I not find favor in your eyes to put the burdens of the nation on me? Hanochi harite kol mezeh, im hanochi liditiu. Did I give birth to the whole nation? Right, he wants to know, like, really, like, I don't understand, like, what is, like, this is not my job. Where am I going to find meat for the entire people? Right, where do you want me to get this from? Like, how am I supposed to serve meat to the entire people?
When he says Es Ha'am and the whole Ha'am, first of all, it's not an army. But anyway,
it's a good dig. Well done. Well done, David.
Is it everybody? Like all 2 million people? Is it little neighborhoods of riffraff people? Like, he's making very big generalizations here.
Well, this is Moshe saying, like, I can't deal with this whole nation. Now, what is the whole nation? That's a good question. Like, we have Am, Adat. Like, there's a lot of different ways to refer to the Jewish people. So when are we talking about, like, pockets? And when are we talking about factions? And when are we talking about
take
the whole nation?
Take the side of it out, because he's using that. Maybe he's frustrated. But when the narrator, let's say it's not Hashem, describing it. So he's using different words. He's using Behiya Am, Kimson and Ra. So he's talking about Ha'am, and then it's the
Ha'am
Pasuk, and then...
But Moshe is saying Kol Ha'am.
But he's saying at Kol Ha'am Hazeh. He might just be pointing to the... river.
Right, so it could be like a faction or something like that.
We're not saying... National polls. Right? Obviously, they don't interview the entire nation. They take what they consider representative sample, about 1,000...
2,000 representatives.
Right. So if you feel you've gotten enough sampling, you extrapolate. They're like, yeah, this is pretty much the general consensus.
They put out, there was a Gallup poll. They made some phone calls.
Is everybody, every tent, in all shvatim, in all directions, are they actually having this conversation now? Or is it some people that happen to be near Moshe and he heard it?
It's not everybody.
There's a lot of people, but if they dominate the conversation, then it's
right. And it depends on where the 1% lives. Meaning, if the 1% is one community, we don't know. Okay, so Moshe says, I cannot carry the entire people. It's too much. And if this is what you're going to do, and if that's the case that you want to make me do all this, so just kill me. That's what he says. So first off, what's the deal with these complaints in general? So Rav Moshe Lichtenstein has a beautiful idea where he says that there is a, which I don't remember it. It was either Shmuel or Steve who said this, I think, that the difference, or maybe Greg, was... It was definitely on this side of the room. So the complaints that they're making here are different because it's not requests for things that they need. It's like they're looking for the luxuries in life, right? Meaning, like, you know, it's one thing, like, you need to be able to, You need to have shelter. You need food. You need clothing. Like, those are the basics. And, like, those are things, if you don't have them, like, you're, it's a legitimate, like, argument to say, like, the injustice, it's not fair, right? But to be like, oh, you know what? If only I had full-time help, it would be nice, right? And if only I can go on all these vacations, and if only I had, like, an apartment here, an apartment there, and whatever, and homes all over the place, and my private jet to, you know, take me from one place to another. So that's where, like, it's no longer fair. So Lichtenstein says that in Sefer Shmos, what their complaints were very much based on, like, necessities. No water, we'll die. No food, we'll die. All those things. Now we're going to, like, a new thing where we're going to, if only we had the exotic fruits and vegetables that were maybe only, like, in Egypt. That's what we need, and that's what we don't have. Okay, but still, what is the deal? Why is Hashem so angry? Why is Moshe so angry? And now, listen to what Hashem's answer to the solution is. God says to Moshe, I want you to take 70 men from these Canaan of Israel that are known, that they're the elders of Israel, of the nation, and the Shotrav, and bring them to the Olam Moed, and they'll stay there with you. People are complaining, we need meat. The answer is, let's get rabbis. Like, right? How does that answer their question? Right? Like, we need a kiddush with lots of good food. So what should we get?
The answer is Moshe's question, not the people's question.
Right, but isn't like so?
It's not helpful to Moshe per se.
Right, so one possibility would be is that there's two complaints. There's Moshe's complaint, there's the people's complaint. Even though the people complain first, Moshe's complaint is second. And then what's God's answer first? I'm going to take care of you, Moshe. And then afterwards, I'll take care of the people. Right? And that could be like, you know, the important, like, you know, message that you get on the airplane, right? Like, if the airplane goes down, people with little children, what should you do first? Okay, take care of yourself, because if you don't take care of yourself, you won't be able to take care of your kid, right? Okay, fine, so maybe that's it. Moshe Rabbeinu is in, like, extreme crisis mode, and God turns to him and says, okay, like, you need help. Let me help you, and then we'll help the other way also. So that is a possibility, but... I mean, he had leaders already. What's the difference between these? These are not, they're not like judges. They're leaders of some sort. I'm not really sure what the difference is in terms of the functionality of them, but it's a good question. So Rabbi Riskin wants to know, like, how do rabbis answer the problem here? So Rashi obviously is going to say, you're saying you can't do it by yourself. So, here are some other people, right? And who are these Zkenim? Who are these Zkenim? So, we have Zkenim from 2 years ago back in Egypt. What happened to those Zkenim? So, Rashi says those Zkenim died in Tavera. They were just killed. Why? Because they deserved to be killed back at Matan Torah by Yechasu as Elokim. They looked up at God. But God didn't want to ruin Matan Torah, so he waits. And now, like, their bill was due, and they're killed. So, fine. So who are these new Zkenim? So Rashi tells us that these Zkenim were the ones that were the Shotrim in Egypt. They were the ones that in Egypt were the Jewish taskmasters that were supposed to beat up the Jews to get them to work harder, and they didn't. They refused to do it. So they're the perfect leaders because they showed extreme empathy to the Jews once upon a time. And therefore, when it comes to here, the assumption is that we're going to have this same situation existing and they'll take care of the Jewish people. So the Abar Ben El, though, says, if you take a look at the very end of the Abar Ben El statement, he says, Natano chaverim umisayim behanagato. What he got was he got peers, right? He got people to work with. So I can't speak about like any other profession other than education, but like at least it's one that I know well. And they say in education that the loneliest position is the principal, right? Because teachers, first of all, teachers like commiserate with each other. And in many schools, their rallying point is the principal, right? Like we're all on the same page that we don't like the principal. So there is like a lot of like unity that way. Right. But the principal is all alone. So in all these like self-help books for principals and all these like, you know, articles you read, like this is what they tell you. Principals need to find principals in other schools. Generally principals that are far enough away from them, they're not competing schools. And then like when you have a rough day, you call them, you're like, hey, Rabbi so-and-so, you know, like, oh, wow. And the person just listens and goes, I hear you. We were there last week. And that's it. So Moshe is in the loneliest position in the world because he is the ultimate leader of the entire nation. And he doesn't really have a peer other than maybe Aaron. So he gets Chevra. And the Chevra is supposed to help him. That's what the Abar Benel says. So okay, that's a possibility. So so Rabbi Riskin has another difference. And this is what he says. The Jews at this point were complaining with no real complaints. There was nothing to complain about. But when they reach the point where they're complaining with nothing to complain about, it's clear that they no longer were inspired by the mission that God had given them. Meaning when they got to Sinai, they were like super excited. God was taking them from Egypt, making them into Avadim LaHashem. They were going to be servants of God. There was a certain passion about the mission that was in front of them. And then that kind of like passed. And God is disappointed. And God says, you know what? I'll give you what you want. You want meat? That's Pasuk Yud Zayin Tochav. You'll have meat. You're going to have so much meat that you're going to eat it for a day. You're going to eat it for a week. You're going to eat it for a month. It's going to be coming out of your nose. That's how like nauseated you'll be by it. Okay. But listen to me carefully, God says. I'm giving it to you, but I'm still disappointed. But maybe at a certain point in time, your cravings will be fulfilled. And then you'll realize that you need something more. Right? Often, we have people in life that, like, they go searching. And they don't know what they're searching for. So they think that, like, they'll find their happiness in things. They'll find their happiness in money. They'll find their happiness in work. And then eventually, what happens? I mean, you see this, like, sadly, when you read, like, articles by people that, like, completely, like, destroy their lives with drugs and alcohol. And, like, when they hit rock bottom and they're in, like, intense, intense therapy, they'll be like, what do they find all of a sudden? Or people in jail, what do they find all of a sudden? I found God. Why do they find God? Because after a while, when you realize that what I thought was going to give me fulfillment didn't give it to me, then I seek something else. God says, I will let you fulfill all your desires. But after you reach that point, you might realize that you're still looking for something, and that something is not a physical thing. It's something spiritual. You're going to come back to your original mission. And when that happens, what are you going to need? Rabbis. That Rabbi Riskin says is the message is what Moshe Rabbeinu's answer is, or God's answer is to the Jewish people. You lost your mission, you lost your path, you lost your way. We gotta refocus. You're not gonna be able to refocus right now. You are too consumed with your need for meat. So here, I'm gonna give you so much quail, so much of it, it's gonna fulfill every one of your dreams and then some, and then you're gonna be sick of it. And then when that happens, what will happen? Hopefully you'll seek inspiration somewhere else. I'll end with a story. It's a true story. I might have shared this once upon a time, but it is genuinely true. When I was in high school, as many high school students do, sometimes you do stupid things. So one of the stupidest things I did, which thank God in the grand scheme of things was not terribly stupid, was I was in the YU CAF. And whatever they were serving that day was like, it just like didn't really do it for me. And I went to the YU CAF store and they were selling a Junior Entenmann's cheesecake. Now, Junior Entenmann's cheesecake, this is back in the 90s. So like nowadays, this would be a Junior Entenmann's cheesecake. But back then, at least this was an Entenmann's Junior cheesecake. And I was like, you know what? I'm gonna eat that for lunch. And I'm eating it. And like the first third of this cheesecake is like, it's like I was like in a special place. The second third of that cheesecake, I was no longer in a special place. And by the last part of the cheesecake, which I don't think I finished, I was in a very, very bad place. But I could tell you at that point in time that if there was a rabbi that had been there, I think I might have been inspired. Because anything at that point in time was better than that cheesecake. I think that's Rabbi Riskin's point. Is that God says, I'm going to let you fulfill everything that you want and need. But then you're going to realize that it's empty. And when you realize that it's empty, what are you going to do? You're going to look for something. Why does that thing have to be far away from you? Let those 70 people be amongst you and let them be the voice that guides you, hopefully, towards something higher and better.